This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. As a regular listener, you know that from time to time I like to feature something that's a little bit unique and not just necessarily a conversation with one of my friends and for all of us kind of learning something as we go, including myself. But again, there are, for an example, book authors that I like to talk with. Now, there are a lot of books, there are a lot of DVDs and new products coming out all the time, and this is not the type of podcast that is intended to be promoting somebody's one-time thing, their newest trick or whatever. I'm glad that people are putting these out, and that's all great. But when there's something that I think that needs to be drawn to the attention of the magic community that's a little bit different, I like to post something like that here. And this week is one of those exceptions in which that we are going to talk a little bit about a new book that is out by Nate Staniforth. Now, Nate is a friend of mine, actually kind of goes way back. He's a young man who, compared to me, a young man who's been involved with the college industry for a long time, doing college shows, and had gotten involved with Brian Brushwood and, I guess, inspired by Brian, and went on into the college circuit. And that's where he'd met my son, Nick Wells, when Nick was working with Brian back then also. So they had got to be friends. Well, anyhow, this book was brought to my attention that he had recently published. I should say, actually, that Bloomsbury was a company that published it, but he had recently completed the writing on this, and it's now available. But it's a phenomenal book. It's the first book, I will say, that I have actually taken a highlighter and highlighted some key passages that are things that I wanted to go back to and think of. Man, I mean, almost in every chapter there's something in here that that makes you think. And it's that kind of a thing where it's really not, this is a book really for non-magicians, I would say, for the most part. That's why that I believe Bloomsbury had picked it up, because it has a wide appeal. This is not a book of tricks by any means. In fact, tricks aren't discussed at all. It's a journey of one man who is looking for mystery and trying to rekindle that mystery that he had as a child, and then to be able to share that mystery with his audiences. And I think that you'll learn a lot from his journey and his experiences. Even if you don't read the book, at least just from listening to this podcast, we got into some pretty deep and philosophical and theoretical kinds of conversations here, and so I think there's a lot to learn in all this podcast from start to finish. Now, we started off with this podcast, and I want to apologize up front in talking about the college circuit, because I thought we might begin talking about the college circuit and kind of how I got into that and what it's like working on the college circuit. That's something that we'll talk with another magician at a future date, but it's not for this podcast. Even though at the beginning that we say, well, we're going to talk about the college circuit and all that, we really don't get into that. We get into a lot other, actually more meaningful things that I'm sure that you will not only be entertained but educated by listening to this. The name of his book that was released is called Here Is Real Magic, and it is really, again, a journey of his that goes from when he is a youth, but more importantly, when he travels over to India, the land of mystery, and finds real magic there. And there are a lot of things that can be applied. It's not just, it certainly doesn't read like a memoir or a diary or something that's like, okay, well, that's pleasant. This is something that will be meaningful to you. In fact, as he says at the end of this podcast, that he had someone who had given a copy of this to their parents to say, this is the reason why that I am into magic and want to pursue magic as a career. It is a very good book. I highly recommend. And if you don't believe me, you can read it for yourself when you get a free copy. And I say, what? A free copy? Yeah, we're going to be giving away 3 copies. Be sure to stay tuned at the end of this podcast to learn how that you can register to win a copy for yourself. And but in the meantime, let's listen to what Nate has to say. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Nate Staniforth, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast.com, and I am speaking with someone here today who I know a lot of you guys would have a lot of interest in that, and that has to do with the college circuit and going to NACA and that kind of a thing. And I've been asked from time to time about what that's like. I have worked in just about every conceivable type of venue personally, from Vegas to trade shows and cruise ships and corporate shows and birthday parties, but I've never done anything, you know, in the college circuit. So I'm always fascinated. I'd like to learn more about it, and I really can't speak about this intelligently, so I thought that we'd talk with someone here today who has a great deal of experience in that, and he is also an author of a great new book, which I highly recommend. It's called Here Is Real Magic, and he's been around for a long time, and actually the funny thing is he's known my son longer than he has known me. My son Nick had worked with him and Brian Brushwood way back when in the 2004, 2005, 2006, I don't remember what year, whatever it was. We'll get to that in a minute. So, enough of introduction. Please welcome my friend, Nate Staniforth. Hey there, Nate.
Hi, Scott. Thanks so much for having me on.
Certainly. So, most of that is kind of correct. I was just talking with Nick recently, and he was telling me about, you know, working with you and in those days. What was that? Was when you were kind of getting involved with Brian Brush. Was that around 2004-ish, 3, something like that? Do you remember?
Yeah, my first year on the college circuit was 2005. You know, I just finished college, and while I was in school, my last year, I was doing, you know, college shows. I perform at frat parties and sorority parties, and there was a venue above a bar in town that gave me the space every week to do a show. And so after I finished school, it was sort of just an intuitive leap to step into the college circuit, because I had been performing for that audience anyway.
Right. Well, that was kind of with me. I was in the energy business for a long number of years, and whenever I started doing some trade shows, I was specializing in the energy business because I already knew the talk and I knew the people, and it was an easy transition. I would think so too, that you are a college student and then a graduate, and you're working for people who are your same age, and you've already done it. So that certainly does make sense like that. You know, Nick was my son Nick Wells was a an intern for Brian Brushwood, his first intern, and we got to travel a lot with him, and that's when he had met you, and he had shared a video with me then also of you, which I'm going to put a link to this on the blog here later.
Oh, man.
It goes back to 2007 when you were doing a chain escape with some weights and everything, and you chained yourself up and jumped into a freezing lake and out of this boat. And that was when, apparently, 2007, you were already on the college circuit, and that seemed like a crazy stunt.
That video was actually filmed in 2002.
Oh, okay.
Maybe even 2001. I was not a very attentive student in college, because I discovered pretty early on that, you know, I went to college on a theater scholarship because I thought that studying stagecraft would be a way to help me become a better magician.
Yeah.
And to be clear, I knew going into college that I would leave as a professional magician. So my only agenda as a student was to extract as much knowledge that I could possibly, you know, bring to bear on my work as a magician and then leave. I just wanted to learn what I could to help myself be a better performer. And what I found very quickly, though, is that you know, it's easy to get lost in the theories about stagecraft and the theories about theater, but I learned far more after class doing magic for people than I ever did pursuing those ideas in a more theoretical way.
So it really seemed like the College of Hard Knocks. I mean, it was the experience of doing it rather than the in-room classes.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, I switched to study history and religion because I was fascinated by both of those subjects, and I thought that, you know, maybe that could help me in some way as a magician. But during my freshman year, the university opened up their cable network channel to the students. Anyone who wanted to make something and put it on TV could do so, as long as it, you know, looked. They had a certain minimum requirement for what you could put on TV, but there's this group of filmmakers who was really excited to make, you know, content and put it on television. And so I worked out this deal with them where they would come along to all of my shows, and, you know, we'd do street magic and stage performances, and then every week we'd put it into a TV program and put it out on the cable channel. And we decided at the end of that year that we needed something big to end the first season. And, you know, I had always been fascinated by Houdini. And so we came up with this idea of doing a Houdini underwater style stunt, you know, where I'd be locked and chained and weighted.
Yeah.
And then jump into the river that flowed through class.
Wow. And it looked like it was freezing water also. It looked, that was a fall or winter up there?
It was awful, Scott. We had to delay it for 2 weeks because the river was still frozen over.
Oh,
yeah, it was
man.
Still iced over. So we had to delay the escape. But you know, even after the river thaws, it's still really cold for a long time. So I took it very seriously because, you know, I had learned, and I think every magician can relate to this idea that you think you prepare for everything. Mm-hmm. And then when you're actually on stage, the thing that goes wrong is something that you never even considered.
Right.
So I, you know, I was running, I was holding my breath for as long as I could. I was doing wind sprints while holding my breath in class, like during lecture, I would just sit and see how long I could go without breathing. And, you know, I was doing all the preparation that you do for a river escape. And you know, by the time it was the day arrived to do the escape, I was ready. I could hold my breath for long enough. I could do the locks, no problem. I planned for everything except one really critical detail. And that was, in order to film the event properly, we had to have a camera crew right there in a boat. You know,
right.
So we had this camera guy on the boat in the middle of the river. But you know, a river has a current. So in order for the boat to not just get swept down river, it had to have its engine running. So I jump into the river and I've got locks and chains and weights and I sink to the bottom. But as soon as I escape from the weight that's pinning me to the surface of the river, I start floating back up to the surface towards the spinning, like the river was sweeping me under the boat towards the spinning propeller.
Oh, man.
And so there is this moment of just pure incredulity where I realized that I wasn't going to drown because I had prepared for that. That was going to be fine. I was going to get hacked to death by this spinning propeller that I
wow.
never even considered. So when you look at the video, you can see me swimming away as I'm breaking the surface of the river.
But yeah, I was noticing that you were further away and I thought maybe the current had taken you away down there, but you were intentionally trying to get away from the boat.
I was trying not to get chopped bits.
Up.
Yeah.
Well, so the advice you're giving anybody who wants to try this is to use a rowboat.
The advice I'm giving is to think of a better idea and never try anything so stupid as that.
Now, you're saying you want to do something kind of like what Houdini had done, and I had read or seen in the movies or whatever where he would be taking ice baths. Did you prepare by doing something like that also?
Oh, I sure did. Yeah, but you know, I was living in the dorm, so I didn't have a bathtub.
Uh-huh.
So the only option I had was to turn the water, yeah, as cold as it would get. And the coldest water I could get to come out of the showers was 65 degrees, which is pretty cold.
Yeah.
The water that I measured at the surface of the river was 52 degrees, and it was even colder down below. So it was, yeah, it was a weird day, and I don't recommend it at all. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing it up, by the way.
Yeah, so that was a while back. And so, yeah, the interesting thing is, I guess, that you kind of did the television shoot, you know, for that, for the program. So it sounded like that was one of the first YouTube videos that you'd probably put up there when YouTube was still in its infancy. So I suspect you probably had a lot of views.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. This show happened before YouTube was invented. I think YouTube came out at the end of my senior year. And so, you know, I had been trying to find a way to share my work on video for years. And for a long time, that was, you know, in college, it was putting that TV show up on the cable channel. But I also did this experiment where I would, you know, this was back in the days of VHS tapes.
Sure.
I would make a copy of just some magic that I'd done, and I'd put it on a VHS tape, and then I'd leave it around town, like just on a park bench or at a seat in a coffee shop. And I tried to make it look as mysterious as I could. So there was nothing on it except I said something like, if you find this, email. And then I created some random email address.
Wow.
And this was – you have to remember, this was back before people – knew to be worried about like email scams or anything like that. And so I'd get these emails from people who had found the video and watched it, and they just wanted to let me know that they found it and passed it on to someone else. It's like I was just searching for ways to share my work on video, because, you know, even – after that first iMac came out where you could edit your own video, I just loved this idea of, you know, you could make your own TV show, even if you didn't have a TV deal to share magic with people.
Right, right.
Anyway, I did a lot of experiments like that.
You know, that kind of reminds me a little bit of the the fellow's name just escapes me for a moment, no pun intended. But he put out this thing called Creating Wonder, and he would have these decks in glass bottles, and he would hide them in different places. And so there were contests for people to try and find them. But it was the same kind of thing. The people then would be actually out searching for these things because they actually have value, you know, the deck itself and the fact that it's a wonder glass or a wonder bottle or something, you know, so that there's, you know, a deck of cards inside of a bottle, but it's hidden someplace like under a park bench or someplace, you know, in Canada or something. So
I love that idea so much. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing when you can take, you know, take magic and take it outside of the context of a theatrical performance and put it in the real world and let it live there.
And really creating wonder.
Yeah, for sure. Are those Jamie Grant's bottles?
Thank you that very much. I knew it would come to
you. Those are so well made. Those are incredible bottles.
Yeah. Fortunately, I have one. Not one that I found that I bought, but I've got in my collection here. But Jamie is quite a fellow, too, that I hope to get to chat with sometime in the future. Well, so one of the things, going back just a minute, then, Nate, to as far as college, what you were saying that you'd been a magician, obviously, for a long time since you were a youth, and that your intent in going to college was to learn more of the stagecraft and everything. Now, I always recommend if someone is wanting to become a magician that, yes, they should study that, but they should also study business. So this way that they know the business side of it. Because, for an example, in another profession, let's say in medicine, whether it's you're going to be a doctor or a dentist or something in the medical field, these guys are very intelligent. However, that a lot of times that they haven't taken the business classes, so they don't have the business acumen to be able to handle personnel in their offices and other kinds of day-to-day things. They'll hire other people who will be office managers or accountants and people to work for them because they can't really do the business. They're very good at operating on people and, you know, figuring out what's wrong with them and diagnosing symptoms and treating them, et cetera. But my point is that I think it's important that a magician should also not only learn the stagecraft and the theater and choreography and everything else that goes with it, but also learn business, because that's what it's about, you know, is show business. That's two-thirds of it, is the business of trying to understand about how to book yourself and marketing and all the rest of that as well. So,
you know, I think if I had heard that when I was 19, I would have rebelled against it. And I would have thought, if I just create art that's good enough, eventually it will work out. Someone will pay me to make it. And now, having done this for a number of years, I agree with you wholeheartedly. There's a world of difference between having a dream and having a plan. And the first step absolutely is to have the dream. But then you have to find a way to make it work. And I wish that while I was in school, I had, even just for one semester, just one class, like how to read a P&L sheet, just the very basics of business.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, I think there's this thing in our culture where it's sort of assumed that art and commerce have to be enemies. And I have come to believe that that's not true at all, that one of the ways to protect your art is by building a good business around it, because, you know, no one will ever see your magic if you don't have shows, and you won't have shows if you can't support all of the sort of, you know, systems that go into booking shows,
right,
and maintaining those. You know, there's that whole architecture to a magician's career that I learned in a very awkward and ungainly way, but I could have saved so much time, you know, had I done what you're advocating and just approached it more pragmatically.
Right. You know, that's not the fun part of the of that, because, again, a magician, particularly when you're young, that you, as you just said, Nate, that people are going to, you know, you build it, they'll come. And if I'm a magician, people will want to see it. And but you've got to be able to do the rest of that that's going with it. So that's another thing I always advocate, exactly what you're saying, that, yes, you should dream, but you should also plan, because things will organically happen if you plan properly. It's not if you dream properly, because if you have a plan that one thing is going to be happening, you know, I have a 1 year, 3 year, 5 year plan, a 10 year and 15 year plan, and I will ask some young people from time to time, you know, what are those plans you have? You know, where do you expect to be, you know, and with your career as a magician, you know, and 10 times out of 10, they'll say, I'm going to be in Las Vegas, you know. Well, or they might not say that. Say, well, I really don't know. You know, I'm still going to be doing magic. My point in that, whenever I'm telling people, for an example, you're working at a restaurant doing magic and you're doing some close-up. And if you're still doing that 20 years from then and you're wondering, why aren't I in, why am I not in Las Vegas, or why am I not, you know, working wherever else, you know, in Monte Carlo or something? Well, it's because that wasn't part of your plan. You know, you have to actually move forward. And in other words, if it's not working, then you adjust the rudder on your ship to kind of move to the direction that you want. Or if it's not happening, find out why it's not happening. Explore those reasons why it's not happening. So I think it's important that you do have those plans. And I can guarantee you that if you have a plan, your future will come faster. In other words, your five-year plan will happen in 3 years. Your three-year plan will happen in 2 years because you are focused on a plan. And particularly if you actually put it in writing and you put it on a sticky note and you're looking at that every day, you know, that by this date I'm going to have this number of shows, or I'm going to have talk with this many people or whatever, but you have to have that plan. Anyhow, this is not about me. I'm kind of got off on my own lecture tangent here.
No, it's fine. That's how conversations work. It's all good.
Yeah, it sounds like what your advice would be to your younger self would be not just to pursue magic in the theatrical sense, but also from the business sense in college.
Yeah, I and while we're talking about advice to my younger self, there's one other piece that I would add. I think, you know, when I was a teenager and certainly in my early 20s, I had this, how do I say this? It's like I was so worried about making it that it got in the way of, let me say it like this. I think when you're 18, 19, 20, you've got a few really special years that you will not get again later in your career.
That's right.
When you can put all of your time and energy into just becoming great. You can spend it like learn a really good call, learn a really good pass, learn to take a good false shuffle, you know, like take the time where you're working 16 hours a day in front of it. Like just that is the time to learn the technique, to really lock down some of the fundamental skills that you'll need later. Because, you know, I guess I had this sense in my late teens and early 20s that I had to get ready to make it. Any day, like it was time to start sending out videos. It was time to, you know, get ready because the rocket's about to leave. And I think that time would have been much better spent just not worrying for a few years about becoming well known or becoming mm-hmm. successful or, you know, obsessing about the career and just like read Tolstoy, you know, read Tommy Wonder, to just wallow for years in the great minds of history and let that shape your aesthetic vision of who you are and who you could be and what a magician could be. Because a time will come, maybe in your mid-20s, maybe in your late-20s, maybe in your early-30s, where you're just really busy with touring, with shows, maybe with television or videos or, you know, there will be a time when your hours in the day become much, much more precious and much more expensive to spend on any one thing. And so while you're free of those responsibilities, my God, learn as much as you can and practice as much as you can. I mean, it sounds like terrible advice.
No, it's great advice.
Practice harder. Practice harder is I don't know. That has served me well.
That's what they always say, you know, the three things are practice, 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 of course. And what you're saying, I think, is absolutely important, that you should not look at the future necessarily as an immediate goal. Everybody wants to be good and great at everything immediately. And sometimes people will have a goal of being famous. You should never have a goal of being famous. That is an organic thing that would happen as a result of you doing good work. I don't care what it is, and I'm expanding this beyond magic to any and every other profession. If you want to rise within the business of whatever company that you're working for, strive to do the best you can at the job you have, and you'll be recognized for your efforts. And I think the same thing like with magic that, as you have suggested, if you do these when you were younger, that whenever that it comes to the time you actually need these skills and you implement them, you're going to they'll come easily for you, and you will achieve greatness, as a result of the hard work you put in.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I had to deal with Instagram when I was just starting out in my career, yeah. I never would have made it, because the incentive there is for, really quick turnaround, put something quick online and then do it again the next day.
Right.
And that takes so much time that I don't know how I would have, put in how I could have done that and also put in the real necessary work for building a career as a magician. And so I don't know.
As we're talking, and the fact you were talking also about studying religion and some of the topics in college, and we'll get to your book here in a moment, and the things that you talk about, I can see you as being the future Eugene Berger. I'm really paying you a big compliment here, See, there's that laugh.
I've got to work on the voice for sure. But let me throw this out there. I had this idea when I was, maybe 19 or 20, very early on in my career as a magician. And this is not a new idea by any means, but it was new to me. This thought that a great magician needed to know far more than magic in order to really connect with an audience, that having great technique and having a great theoretical background was not the end of the game as a stage performer. Those are sort of like the preconditions to being a good performer, but that the person who would ultimately do the best magic was the person with the best imagination. Yeah. And so I thought that, as essential as it is to study Berglis and to study Eugene Berger and Tommy Wonder and all of these people who have left us these wonderful books to study as magicians, you also have to read literature, you also have to listen to great music and watch great films and listen, just saturate your mind and your imagination with the great artists of history. And you're not doing this just for enjoyment, although you will enjoy it. You're doing it to actively shape your aesthetic sensibilities and your imagination, so that when you go then to invent magic, you're not doing it alone. You've got Dylan there to help you, and you've got Jackson Pollock there, or Beethoven there, all of these artists that you've come to love and respect and mm-hmm. admire. All of the part of you who loves and respects and admires them will then shape the way you approach magic. I remember when I was young, it's like overnight I discovered Bob Dylan, and I listened to everything he had ever recorded. And and once you really let that work into you and into your heart and your mind and the your imagination, it fundamentally alters the way you approach magic, because all of a sudden there's entire shelves of magic books that are much harder to relate to. It's hard once there's a period in time where I listened to Beethoven's Seventh Symphony every single day. It would take 50 minutes and I'd listen to it as I was practicing magic. And I did that 7 days a week for a year.
Wow.
And it wasn't because I loved it at the beginning, but it's because it's like there was something in it that I wanted to be part of my magic, and I didn't know how to do it other than to just saturate myself in it. And that, I feel like that more than anything, if I am honest about the material that I'm doing in my show, in my live show, there are a few pieces that involve technical sleight of hand, but most of it doesn't. Most of it is more, it's based on theory than hardcore technique. But it's been shaped as much by my imagination as a performer and as an artist than my technical abilities. And I don't know, that's been an idea that's been really important to me.
But is that something that you developed over the time of performing while you were on the college circuit day after day and month after month? Or was it something after you had returned from your tour of India? And we'll get to that here in a minute, too. But in other words...
No.
Okay.
Yeah, that started from the very beginning. I remember when I was in college, I saw Ken Burns' documentary on Frank Lloyd Wright, mm-hmm. and I just thought, oh man, there is so much more to being an artist than knowing a good a good pass. That knowing a good pass does not make you an artist. It might make you a card technician, but if you want to create, if you want to, you know, create something and build something, you need more than just technique.
Well, that's absolutely correct. Yeah, that it is a combination of everything which makes you valuable, because it's your personality, which is a combination and a culmination of all of these other outside influences. And that's why that your mind should be open to a lot of these influences, as you suggest, in all kinds of art, whether it's music and or sculpture, literature, science, and whatever else. And so, you know, there was a quote that I – your book, by the way, which I'm anxious to get into in just a minute, is the only book that I've actually taken a highlighter to because of different things. The one was I'm looking at here, it says, do you want to know what the real secret to becoming a great magician is? It's very simple. You just have to care about it more than anyone would ever consider possible. It is amazing. Yeah. You know, I think you do have to have a dedication to the art. Just as I talked about doctors, you know, in medicine, they have a dedication to healing people. We have a dedication to perhaps entertaining people as opposed to fooling them. I mean, that you have to kind of understand yourself and why it is that you're getting into it. I mean, is it to win friends and to have influence, or is it to make money, to be famous, to travel, to make more friends, to be well known, whatever it is, you know, kind of, I think before you get into it, and while you're practicing those passes for hours at a time, be concentrating then also on other kinds of things that influence your life, and why is it that you are actually wanting to pursue this? You know, when you're trying to figure out, that way your end game will come easier as far as what your plan is, if you know why you're wanting to do this.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I would also say that an important part of that process is being honest with yourself about whether having a career as magic, right, in magic is right for you. And it doesn't have to be. Look, you know, I think maybe the greatest writer on magic working right now is Andy at the Jerks blog. I think that material is amazing.
It is very funny, very pithy.
And but I mean, it's even more than funny. Like the whole, it's almost like the ethic of it is right, and that is a model of magic that does not work as well when you're known as a professional magician. So look, magic is broad and vast, and there's room for everybody. And if you want to do it as a hobby, it's an incredible hobby. But I would say that, you know, I get messages on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and emails or whatever, just from young magicians asking for advice about whether or not they should become professionals. And the thing that I want to say that maybe I should is that if you're asking me for permission, or if you're asking me for encouragement, this probably isn't for you. Like the people who make it are the people who don't care what other people say. They could have everyone in their life telling them that this is a terrible idea, this is not a safe career, you know, you should do something practical.
Right.
The only people who stand a chance are the ones who know in their heart of hearts that this is it, that the rest of the world, you know, can do whatever it wants to do, but they're going to do this. Because the thing that you don't know when you're 18 and 19 and 20 is how miserably, pitifully, soul-searingly difficult it is going to be. It's just going to be a fight from beginning to end. And I think even the magicians who look like they've made it will tell you the same thing. It's just tough. It's always tough. You know, there's that great Houdini quote. He said, "The real secret to my success is simple. I work from 7 in the morning to midnight, and I like it." And if that's you, great. And if it's not you, if you're not excited about that, there probably is something else in the world that you would be excited about, and you should give yourself permission to find that.
That's a very good point. I think that does transcend to other professions, again, that if it's not magic that you like, perhaps it might be in engineering, or it could be in teaching, law enforcement, whatever it might be, there is something that you would have a passion for. Sometimes magic is just a fleeting thing, and it becomes a hobby because you don't have the passion for that as you do for something else, and that's fine. You should pursue your passion. As I've heard people say before, that if you love what you're doing, you never work a day in your life, because that's a true love and a passion for you. There are others who might be trying to, because they do have the passion for magic, but they are not successful financially and end up having to do something else, but just keep coming back to magic because that's their passion. That's because there's something lacking in there, and that could, again, be part of the lack of planning and the lack of business acumen. So, but yeah, I think that you do have to work hard at it. And I think if you talk with anybody who's the top of their field, let's say Matt King or Amazing Jonathan or whoever, I mean, those guys just didn't become overnight sensations, you know?
No, I mean, yeah, that's right. And I think even if you do love it, you know, I've heard that quote before, if you love what you do, then you don't ever work a day in your life. And that's not been my experience. I mean, I love magic more than just about anything. And it can be a passion and also a grueling job at the same time. Those are not mutually exclusive. And
sure.
I could talk about that forever.
Well, yeah, we have a limited amount of time, because I do want to talk about your book that was brought to my attention, and it is a fascinating read, certainly. And that's one of the reasons, again, that I kind of was saying it. You're like a modern day Eugene Berger, from the standpoint of the different things you're bringing in and the cosmic way that you're looking at life and magic. The title of the book is called Here Is Real Magic. And when was this actually released?
The book came out in the U.S. on January 16th. It'll be out in the U.K. on April 19th, and the rest of the world, we're 2 weeks out from the rest of the world release. So it'll be everywhere shortly.
And your publisher, who published it?
It's out through Bloomsbury Publishing, who's best known for Harry Potter, but they also did, I don't know if you know Anthony Bourdain.
I do.
The travel host and chef,
sure,
and
chef.
His first books came out through Bloomsbury as well.
Oh, interesting. So there are so many other magic books that are out there, and I, give people from time to time, who will say, hey, look, I've got a new book I'd like to try to promote. Well, this is not about book promotion. I mean, it's not like that kind of a talk show where, what's new, and
sure,
particularly if it's a trick book, and because there are books about tricks coming out all the time, but this was completely unique and different from, I've had other authors who have written fiction about fictional magicians, and they've been fascinating as to the detective novels, and those fascinate me also. But this is something that comes from real experience. This is really kind of an autobiography of where you are to date and what you had done, starting from when you were a youth, then all the way pretty much to where you are then now. And
yeah, I mean, oh, I'm sorry.
No, that was it. I wasn't going to a question. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the goal was to share with the general public. You know, this is a book for the general public about magic, because I feel like magic is not not the least understood of the art forms. It's the most misunderstood. It's not that people don't know about magic. It's that they actively think something about it that's not true or no longer true. And I wanted to tell everyone that they're sort of, if their perception of magic is of laser beams and smoke machines and Job from Arrested Development, that they're missing out. I communicated that by sharing my experience, but I think it's a story that so many magicians could have told in their own way, and with their own particular details. It's a book about wonder, not a book about magic tricks. And
correct.
And my experience, I got into magic because I loved the experience of being amazed by things. Like, even before I knew there were such things as magic tricks, I loved the experience of magic. And magic for me has always been a way to chase that. One of the things you learn so early on as a magician is that one of the best ways to experience wonder yourself is to share it with other people. And at least in my experience, as I was touring year after year after year, I became really jaded and disillusioned and burnt out. You know, by the time I was 26, I had been on the road full time for 5 years and I was ready to be done. I thought I walked off stage in the middle of the show at Marquette University in Milwaukee, thinking that I was just going to quit everything and, you know, maybe work at Starbucks or something. Mm-hmm. I didn't end up doing that. And the book is the story of, you know, I guess coming to really love the experience of wonder and then losing sight of it as a full-time professional and then fighting to get it back.
Yeah, I think that, again, this could be the story of anybody, but I think that yours is quite unique. I have gotten that before whenever I was not a full-time professional magician, but once that I did and I changed my passion and my hobby into my vocation, that people would ask, well, what is it like when you actually do that? And I think that is not just a passing question like, you know, how are the Cubs doing, you know, or whatever, that they're seriously right. interested in the answer, because everyone has an interest and they're wondering, could I pursue my dreams and become successful then also? And so, again, the question is, have you become disillusioned, or is it not as much fun once you actually are doing this on a full-time basis? And the answer is, you know, no, that I'm having a great time. You know, it's even exceeded my expectations and probably should have done it earlier maybe. But the point is, I think that with your path then also, that you had done this, you'd gone through a lot of soul searching to begin with, I guess, before that you kind of found this, or someone found you, was an interesting story. Again, every magician has their own path, and really I see this book as an accounting of your journey, not just in magic, but in life, in pursuit of your individual truth. And what it is that impacts you and makes makes magic in your life, and how you see magic in the world and the universe. But I see other people having a completely different experience, because, I mean, you had gone, as you said, to the point where it's like, you know, I'm just burned out right now and I've got to get that spark back again. And you just kind of chucked everything, and you have a wife and a family, and she was very supportive to allow you then to travel to India, to the land of mystery, and start seeking these mysteries and find out what real magic is. That must have been really kind of gut-wrenching to have to make that decision and leave and say, you know, I've got to, you know, just take some time. I got to, you know, regroup here.
Yeah. Yeah, gut-wrenching to be sure. You know, it's, yeah, I think many magicians who travel for a living, you know, they can relate in their own way to the struggle that comes from having a family and that you really love spending time with, and also just the necessary obligations of traveling for work and business. And you know, I have two young boys now. I didn't have my children when I went to India.
Okay.
And I don't know if I could have done the trip if I had.
That would have been difficult.
But I will, you know, my wife, Catherine, has just been amazingly supportive, because, you know, it's like she could see what was happening. She could see that, that I wasn't the same person that she had met years before, because I was just, you know, anyone who's ever gone on tour knows that you only get like 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night, any night. And when you do that for 5 years, it's impossible to not let that shape you. And
that's true. You know, I was talking with Banachek about that so many years ago, and he bought a van, because they put you up in a motel or different places along the college tour, wherever you're traveling. But he had a van because he'd say, you know, I'm just going to sleep in this. And so he had a nice travel thing, so he could pull in into a parking lot and he could drive, you know, while you're up after a show. And then when he gets tired, pull over, basically, as opposed to, you know, having to go to a motel. And that was, you know, just getting a few hours sleep here and there. And I recognize that's a pretty hard life, you know, being on the road like that. And it, today we don't have the nightclubs and everything that they had of yesteryear, where that people would travel from nightclubs. And so it seems that where the traveling magician is now is on the college circuit.
It's colleges and it's, you know, music venues. I know some people are playing comedy clubs. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a lot going on in the small theater circuit right now. And so, you know, I think, you know, I'm envious sometimes of musicians or comedians, because there's a more established infrastructure for a career to develop. You know, as a band, you record an album and you play basements and backyards, and then you play small clubs and then you play bigger clubs, and right. there's sort of a way to do it in the music world, and that doesn't exist in magic. And so,
good point.
Like my manager's in the music world, and so we're sort of hijacking that model and applying it to magic. But all of the people I know who are doing this as a full-time living have their own system and their own way of doing it. Maybe it's churches, maybe it's comedy clubs, maybe it's just YouTube videos. You know, there's a lot of different models now. And so I think a couple things. One, you find the one that fits you, or also you just try a lot of things and find out what works.
Right.
And you'll work it out.
Now, when you had gone to India and you spent some time and you had your friend Andy, who was a photographer and taking all the photos and everything, a lot of times after a magician would write lecture notes or a book or something, they will go back on reflection and say, well, I should have put this in, or I could have added this or something. Were there other stories in your notebooks that perhaps didn't make it in that you wish would have, or some other stories in India or experiences of wonder that you had?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I was in India for a long time and there are many stories, but with the book, I wanted to be very careful to not have it just be a story of my adventures, because no one cares about that. Right.
Well, I thought that one armed monkey, you know, that was chasing you was pretty funny with a band of monkeys and all that.
That's right. But even if you take that example, like that is about 250 words of comedic interlude between two pretty heavy interviews, and so or ideas, and so it's told through my perspective, but the goal isn't to just tell people stories about the things that I've seen and done. It's to use I guess my experiences to communicate a set of ideas that I think are important and that matter to me. I think the best memoirs aren't actually about the people who write them, right? They're about an idea or a belief or a conviction or a question that can be illuminated through the telling of that person's story. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was really selective about what made it into the book, and you know, there are chapters and chapters and chapters that got cut because I wanted it not to just I didn't want it to be a book about me. I wanted it to be a book about wonder, the experience of wonder, how to find it, how to share it with other people.
It didn't read like a travelogue. It really read more like an introspection and a journey where you were finding new things all the time and experiencing wonder and sharing these ideas. So were these edits, I should say, I guess, where, you know, some chapters or, you know, stories were left out, were those conscious decisions of yours, or were those by the editor once you had submitted it and they said, well, let's focus on this and eliminate that? And I'm sure they gave you a lot of ideas too.
You know, I was astonished at how hands off the publisher was.
Oh, really?
I got the book deal on March 3rd, 2015. And I had a year to write the first manuscript or the first draft. And I missed that deadline by 6 months. And, you know, they were very accommodating. And, you know, I wrote the book sort of like you'd film a movie, where you film the wide master shot and then you film some close-ups. And the thing with a book is you can put the camera inside characters' heads, right?
Sure.
And so I filmed from all of these angles, and then it was in the edit that the book really came together, because I had all of this, you know, just to continue the metaphor, I had all of this footage, and most of it ends up on the cutting room floor. Mm-hmm. But from that, you know, much larger body of text, I was able to carve out the book that exists now.
Well, I agree what you were saying earlier also. This certainly is not a book about magic. In fact, there are no tricks. You discuss a few things. You mentioned the names of some things or what you're going to be doing, but certainly not any methods, but just the effect of the trick that you're trying to use in this example. But it's really more of a book about a journey, and it can apply towards others, I believe. So it's not something that I'm reading about someone else's life and, oh, it's a nice little story. You know, I recommend the book because I think it's something that can relate personally to me or to anyone who would read this, because I can see through your eyes, as you say, this film that you had made, basically, and envision exactly things you're saying, because your grasp of the English language is to be commended. I think it's one of the most well-written books. And as I'm reading these things, that's why I was highlighting so many things, because they were crafted so well. And I had to think, you know, when you were saying that you were going back to your room and writing for hours in your notebook that you had, so you don't forget a lot of the things, but then you flesh these things out. Yeah, as you write a book, it's not easy, and you write and rewrite. But my point is that this is something I believe, as people would read this, that they would be able to get a lot out of it as well by learning from your experience and in a way experiencing what real magic is for themselves through your eyes.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. And I, you know, as for the writing, I think one thing that all good magicians have in common is that you know, we are good at getting better at things. Because when you learn, like when you learn the guitar, you're learning a set of chords and scales that you can apply to any number of songs. But with magic, it's different. With magic, it's not like you're actually learning magic. You're just learning this technique that allows you to accomplish one illusion. And so, you know, some pieces might rely on sleight of hand. Some might rely on a psychological technique or a memory technique. So there's so many different things you have to learn that when I decided I was going to write a book, I just started, you know, it's like as a magician, you learn how to just do something every day. And so I started writing first 15 minutes a day, and then half an hour a day, and then 45 minutes a day, and then an hour a day. And it was like, okay, I have to learn how to write now. I've learned how to do a pass and how to do a call and how to do a false shuffle. So it's like that.
Right. You know, with this, I can certainly see how that this experience would have changed your life. But I'd like to know then, Nate, what practically that it has done as far as what you have put into your current performances that will allow the audience to experience magic in the way that you have.
Yeah, I mean, the whole have you ever been to one of my theater shows before?
I have not.
Okay, so it's I decided after I came home from India, I had some pretty drastic changes that I wanted to make to the show, because it's like I had a better sense of what my intention should be as a magician. And so I lost any interest in entertaining the audience. I just all of the things that I had tried to learn about being an entertainer, I threw out. There's no music in my show. There are moments when it's funny, but there are no jokes. I deliberately break, you know, all of the rules that you would follow if you wanted to have a good theatrical entertaining show. Uh-huh. My entire career is built on the, how do I say this? It's built on the conviction that what is more entertaining than anything are moments that are unforgettable. And if you can deliver moments to an audience that are truly unforgettable, that will capture their attention far more than any deliberate attention to structure or stagecraft or polish, right? And so on one hand, you know, I think you could look at my show and think, God, that's it doesn't look very polished, because it's an open conversation with the audience. It's different every night because it's interactive, and I'm deliberately trying to make it feel like it's not a show. It's just a 90 minute performance where there are eight really strange things that happen. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't know if that would work for other people. It works really well for me. It works far better than my show when I was trying to be, when I was actively trying to entertain the audience.
Well, that was my question, I guess. You know, that how much that changed, and did it change for the better from your audience's standpoint? You might be feeling more fulfilled yourself, because I am now incorporating these ideas and real mystery that I have learned, my inner self and secrets and how to entertain. But I'm sure that was a lot different than before you went to India. So I was just wondering, as far as the experience that the audience has now, are you able to convey that kind of wonder such that you feel like that your shows are much better than they were?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, I guess you'd have to ask them, but I think any performer has the ability to sense, you know, you can read the room.
Of course, right.
And yeah, I mean, I am getting a much better response than I ever did before. Hmm. And again, it's a style that you know, might not work for everybody, but it's the only style that works for me. And so, you know, I love that, that you can, I think magic is such a great time right now, because I feel like we're past the point where everyone feels like they have to try to be David Copperfield, or they have to try to be David Blaine. Mentalism's past the point where everyone has to try to be Darren Brown. Like, yeah. Like there's room now to just find what it is that you have to say that only you can say. Like find the person that you could be on stage that no one else could be, and do that, and do that as well as you can. And
then nobody can ever copy you, because you're you.
Yeah. And you won't copy anybody else, because suddenly looking at what Blaine's doing, or what Copperfield's doing, or what Darren's doing, that it wouldn't fit you in the way that it fits them. And you know what that's done for me is it's made it so much more fun for me to watch other magicians again. There was a time when I didn't want to see anyone's act, because either I'd like it and then I'd be frustrated that they thought of it. And I didn't,
yeah.
Or I wouldn't like it, because I had such strong convictions of how I thought it should be done. And by unashamedly and unabashedly and unreservedly just being the magician that I want to be on stage, it's made it really fun to watch other performers who are doing that in their own way.
You know, you put your finger on something I had not really considered even until just now, and that is, I recall, just as you said earlier, that it seems that we had clones of Lance Burton. We had clones of David Copperfield.
Or sure.
Clones of this, because they were the magician du jour, basically. And now, with the advent of more magic, again, we kind of live in a new golden age where the television is embracing magic. I mean, we've got a new television show here in the U.S. now called Deception. You know, whether good, bad, or indifferent, whatever your opinion is, the point is that there's magic in a regular TV series. In addition to, of course, you know, Penn and Teller Fool Us, with the Masters of Illusion, from Gay Blackstone's show on the CW, and other kinds of things. In addition to those people who go to Vegas and see these other styles of magicians like Matt King and Jerry McCambridge or others who are working. And the point is that there is a wide variety of magicians that the public now sees, as opposed to just having one role model, because again, I believe that young magicians were seeing this one role model, and they would think, okay, he's successful, I'm going to start producing doves also, or he's successful, I'm going to start doing some comedy also, or he's successful, I'm going to start doing a rope routine like his. But now there are so many to choose from, and in particular, when you add the millions of YouTube videos that are out there about magic and magicians, it allows you to go out and be yourself and also see those styles of other people. And so I think there are fewer people, which I'm ultimately getting to here, there are fewer people being clones of others, and there are more people finding their own chi, if you will, you know, their own style today.
Yeah, for sure. And the clones will never make it.
Exactly.
The clones will never make it, because we've already got Blaine, and he's better than anybody
right.
at being David Blaine.
That's right.
And we already have Darren Brown, and Darren Brown is so good. I mean, my God, is he good. I saw him live for the first time in New York, and it knocked me down. It was just, I could talk about that forever, but my point is that we don't need other people to do that. He's got it, and he's great at that. And same with Copperfield. I mean, Copperfield's doing 500 shows a year, and he is the best version. The original David Copperfield is better than anyone will ever be at trying to be David Copperfield.
Right,
and so I feel like the people who are really having success now aren't trying to be anyone else. They've found what it is that they can do.
Right.
And they're doing it the best they can.
Now, I wouldn't discourage young people or people who are just getting involved with magic of starting to find a hero magician that they can clone, if you will, as long as they recognize that, you know, then they're going to find someone else. They'll start to clone them. So eventually you take a little bit of this guy and a little bit of that guy, and you find that, okay, you throw that out because you have developed your own personality. So now people eventually will be cloning you, you know. But what I'm saying is that it's just like in art. You know, there are people who were when Picasso started Cubism, that other artists started following suit. With Salvador Dali, that there were people then who would do his kind of surrealism art, and they were copying his style. So, and that's the way also that a lot of Impressionist painters began, was by copying literally the style of someone else's until they developed their own. So I'm saying that this is not unprecedented as far as magicians stealing other people's ideas from the standpoint of cloning themselves, because then they can develop their own character and become their own Matisse, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I think the point you made there, that you should not find one magician you admire, but find a number of them.
Right.
Because then you won't be, and make them all different, you know, because then you won't be trying to become any one of them. You'll just be inspired by them. But I mean, I do think that, so look, we live in a time now where it's easier to find technical information on magic than it has ever been, right? You can find it on YouTube. You can order it online. There's so much great magic coming out.
Right.
So allow yourself to be the beneficiary of that, right? And just soak yourself in all of this great technical knowledge from the magic world. But when it comes to aesthetics, when it comes to artistic choices, maybe you don't have to look in the magic community. Maybe you can sit down and think about why you really love the music you really love, and why you love the movies that you really love, or the books that you really love. Find what it is in other mediums that's captured your imagination, and allow that to come into your work.
There was a quote, that was in your book that I will carry with me probably forever. It just kind of it was an amazing quote, and it was something from this poet saying about that art is not something that instructs us of something, but reminds us of something. And I hadn't really thought about that, but whenever I'm looking at a painting, looking at a sculpture, or listening to music, I am not thinking how that I will grow as a result of that, but it's like, hey, that reminds me of a time when X, you know. And so it brings up these memories, which is helpful and pleasant also. You know, I like the color red, or I like the way that this looks, or whatever it is, you know. So it's not so much that it's going to move us forward and instruct us as it is to looking back as a memory. Anyhow, I thought that was kind of fascinating, too.
Yeah, we're not wanting for information. We could sure do with insight, though.
There you go.
And it's a mistake to confuse the two.
Right. Well, as we wrap up over here, let me just, again, I recommend the book. And as you said, it's not a magic book, but it's something that I think that your spouse or significant other or friends and relatives would enjoy even as a gift, because it is a very interesting read and insightful, and I think it could change some other people's lives and as well as they kind of read into this. So where can people find this book? As you say, it's available now and will be soon in the UK. Where can you purchase this?
I mean, it's in most local bookstores. So if you walk into a Barnes & Noble or Waterstones in the UK, or you know, just your local independent bookstore, they'll probably have it. But you can also just go to Amazon and search for Here Is Real Magic. And, you know, I got a comment from someone who read it, and I was really flattered by this, because they said that they had been trying to find a way to explain to their family why magic mattered to them so much, and that they were handing out copies of this to – this guy was giving it to his parents because he wanted them to read it. And I thought that's – I mean, because I think we've all been there, right? Like, when you know you want to be a magician, and everyone in your life who cares about you thinks, why? Why is he doing this?
Yeah,
Please stop. Please go to law school.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. Yeah, so anyway, yeah, if you're interested, you can find it on Amazon for sure.
That sounds great. And do you have any other plans or books in mind or something in the future?
I do. Yeah, I don't know that I'm ready to talk about anything. You know, a couple of years ago, I released one of my original, and I did this lottery prediction, and I wrote a book about that. And I've been looking at a few other original pieces and thinking about releasing those. So I've been thinking about that. And then there's some other books for the public that I'd like to write as well. So a lot of options right now, and I'm just trying to figure out what to do next.
Are there some things that you're actually starting to write on, or are they just still in the outline and planning phases?
It's pretty loose right now. You know, I that book, Here Is Real Magic, took 4 years to write.
Sure.
And before launching into another four-year adventure, or longer, you know, maybe, I'm enjoying this time of just writing and thinking and imagining without an agenda to see what comes up.
Yeah. Well, good luck. That's going to be great. In the meantime, you're going to continue, I guess, that you've found that spark again, so you're back working the theater shows as opposed to doing the college circuit?
That's right. Yeah, I've moved over to the theater world now. I just finished a big winter/spring tour, so I've got some time off now before, you know, another big tour in the fall.
And so when people want to perhaps see your show and they're going to be coming to a town near you, where can they find your tour schedule?
Yeah, it'll be posted on my website. It's just natestanforth.com. And yeah, if I'm coming to your city, please come out and say hello. One of the things that's really been fun for me after this book came out was all of the magicians who've been coming just to say hi. You know, I live in Iowa, and when you live in Chicago or New York, you know, you're surrounded by magicians, and there isn't really a magic community here in Iowa. So it's fun to meet everybody out on the road.
Yeah, I would think that's true, you know, that and also in Chicago or New York or Houston, Atlanta, or wherever, you have magicians coming through working trade shows or other corporate events, and they will stop by to visit and everything. But Iowa is one of those flyover states that people just don't, you know, magicians just don't perform there a lot, I guess.
Yeah, I love it here. I mean, I first moved to L.A. and then Chicago because I thought I had to live in a big city. And I ended up being on the road so much that I wanted to move back home when I was not on the road. But
yeah,
you're right that there are not a lot of touring magic shows that stop through.
Well, to wrap up over here, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. And if anybody should have one after your experience, I would think that you would have a philosophy of life now that would be different from what you had before. But what would be your word or your phrase?
There's a Dylan line that I think about a lot from one of his early records, and the line is, he who is not busy being born is busy dying. And there are days when that inspires me and days where that scares me very badly, but it's an important thought for sure.
Wow, that's a good one to be inspired by that. Well, good. Well, thank you very much, Nate. I appreciate you taking the time to chat with us here today, and also taking the time that you did to share this book with us. And so I, again, would encourage other people to go out and to buy this and to read it. Is it available also like on Kindle as an ebook as well yet?
That's right. Ebook for sure. And I just finished recording the audiobook for Audible. So that should be out in a few weeks as well.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. That sounds great. Well, again, thank you very much. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Nate Staniforth. And this is Scotty out. Wow, that was a good one, and I want to thank Nate Staniforth for being my guest here today. This was a lot of fun, and certainly enlightening. There were some things that I learned not only from reading the book, but also just from talking with the man. So quite inspiring, and I enjoyed it, and I think that you will enjoy reading the book too. As I mentioned the first part of the podcast, you do have a chance to enter a contest and win one of three books that is available from Bloomsbury Publishing, and they will be glad to mail that out to the three winners. All you need to do is go to themagicwordpodcast.com. There you will see a registration form where you can enter your name and email address, and then that will go into a database and generate a random name that will be selected within the next week or two. And when that name is drawn, I'll contact you and then find out your physical address, contact the publisher, and that will be mailed out to you. Now, let me emphasize that this is only open to U.S. residents. So sorry for those who are in Canada and elsewhere who are very near the U.S. Or abroad, but this contest is not open or available to you. The publisher said that they were going to just offer this contest for U.S. residents only. So sorry about that, but that still is open to a lot of people, and please go to the the website and enter to win. If you are overseas, then be sure to still go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you'll see a link where you can order on Amazon. I always encourage people to go and use our Amazon link, because that's another way that even if you can't be a friend of the Magic Word and support us with your financial donation, I know that you buy things from Amazon, and when you do, if you click on the link and go through, then through our affiliate program, we get a little bit back from Amazon then as well. So if you're interested in purchasing the book, then I would suggest if you would please go to themagicwordpodcast.com. There you'll see a link that will take you to Amazon where you can order the book and help the Magic Word Podcast then as well. Well, this has been a pretty full episode with a lot to think on, so I'll just kind of leave it at that and say until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember the Bob Dylan quote, "He who is not busy being born is busy dying." So, keep busy learning and being reborn all the time. This is Scotty out.